This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
Hey, this is Josh from iFanboy.com, and this is another episode of Talksplode, iFanboy's new interview show where we talk to comic book creators about creating comics. That seems very simple. Ron and myself got together and spoke with Rick Remender for a good long while about a lot of the books that Rick's got going on, Fear Agent, Gigantic, End League, Punisher War Journal. There's a lot of books is what I'm saying. And there's a lot of interview here, so we might as well get right to it.
People in Fantown craziness. This is comic book talking on the computer. How about that?
That's awesome. We are here with Rick Remender. And Rick, what is it about comics? You left a fairly successful career in animation and then you decided to do comics. So what is it about the siren song of the panels?
Well, I think everybody's got the same answer, and it's the creative freedom that it offers. I mean, even when you have the restraints of of the continuity-based books and things like a Marvel or DC book, where you've got characters that can only do X, Y, and Z, or there are restraints. Even those restraints don't come anywhere near to the S&M bondage outfit that is most other forms of entertainment work, be it video games or animation.
Since you've been doing this, what do you think? I mean, what have you, like, how are you better at doing comics? Like, what have you learned about doing comics since you've sort of been working in this full time? Like, have you learned more about the art and the way that it works?
Sure. Well, sure. And I mean, I think that I started off, I guess, my dream was that I wanted to be a writer. And as a practicality, I've also always been an artist. And when I was 20 years old, Fox Animation opened up a studio with Don Bluth in Phoenix, where I'd grown up. And so I started a career. I was hired, which was, a great opportunity. And I started my career as an artist, which I focused on for a good 6-7 years before I got back into writing full time. And geez, I mean, I've worn almost every hat at this point, having done storyboards at Electronic Arts and written, 100-something, books at this point. And
you keep count. You totally keep count, don't you? You know the exact number.
127 comic books.
You've got them all.
You've got, wonderful.
You've got every cover up on your wall in your office. I know how it is, Rick.
It's a shrine to myself, a masturbatory, wonderful cave where I am the master and my cats are my subjects.
Yeah. Do you guys do that? Like when you all like hang out, like all comic guys hang out together, you're like, well, so and so has done 350 books, and
Fraction's an
asshole.
Yes. Well, you've only done 87, and I've done 102. I'm a better writer. I do think there's something to be said. The only reason that quantity even comes into play is because you learn with every book. You learn when it's done and the printed version is delivered to you. You learn, if you have time to ever give something that you've written a reread, or once it shows up, if you scan it, you see things that like really make you happy, and you see reveals and turns and, you know, dialogue bits and basic structure, things that you're really happy with. And then conversely, you see just as many things that you're like, you know what, there's a better way to do this. And so, you know, the only reason that the quantity even comes into effect is I think that if you're doing it right, every book you draw or write, you should be getting better. Ideally anyway, but I mean, going back to the question, as for like how much I've learned, I think quite a bit. I think that being being involved in all of the different facets of storytelling in connection with animation and video games and comic books, I understand what can and can't be done on a page and pacing things and, you know, natural story inclination. If you don't have a natural story instinct, you're not going to be able to write very well to begin with. But having done all of this, and especially the quantity that I, like I just mentioned, that I force myself to, you know, because I'm incapable of turning work down or having any sort of a normal human schedule. Ed Burns said, it was one of the guys from The Wire who had worked at the Baltimore.
I was thinking of the actor. I was like, he's not going to have anything important to say.
And I might be misquoting the guy, but the idea that he got across in an interview that I saw was that from working in, you know, newspaper reporters are often end up becoming the best writers because they're forced to move through so many, you know, articles, and they're forced to write so many words every day that you don't get the luxury of pampering yourself, and, you know, which is often a sort of a fear-based boundary. You're subconsciously afraid of something, and so you hesitate. And that's why everybody's like, I've been working on this project for 5 years. You're like, yeah, we'll get it the fuck finished. You know, the faster you're forced to move through things and without the ability to sit back and, you know, and pamper it. I mean, like on most things, in comic books, you write your script, you give it a couple polishes, it goes off to art, it comes back. Once it's lettered, you have an opportunity to maybe polish it once or twice and tweak the dialogue and shift balloons around. And after that, it has to go to print. So you don't get to, you know, sit there and obsess over every single beat of every single line of dialogue. But it does force you, and you learn a lot. You learn quickly. And I think in the past 3 or 4 years, like I look back on some of the things I wrote 4 years ago, and you see so many flaws. You know, I think structurally more than anything, I think I've always had a pretty good ear for dialogue, but structure is something that now that I'm learning more about it and focusing on it and studying it, I think that looking back, that's probably where I get the most sort of like, wow, you know, I really am growing. I really am, you know, getting better at this.
What is there like a thing specifically that you look back at, sort of the first few things you wrote that you saw yourself doing a lot that you don't do now or that you're aware of?
There's a lot of different things. You know, there's so many, you're juggling so many balls, literally, you're keeping so many plates spinning. Let's go with that analogy. And when you're writing a story, there's so many things to keep in mind. Giving the reader a chance to look around the world, you know, is really important. Like in Doll and Creature, for example, which was the first book that I ever wrote, and that was like 99, 2000, that I didn't have a co-writer. I just wrote the thing by myself. I looked back on that not too long ago and realized that there's never really an opportunity for the reader to look around what at this world. I set them in this world where religion is illegal. And you know, the left has become the mainstream, and the right is in the underground. And you know, up is down, and everything's topsy turvy. But the reader's never really given an opportunity. And I'm not, you know, shitting on the book. I think it still holds up fairly well. Go buy it. But there are some flaws in the structure, mostly. I think more than anything else, not having your structure laid out, not having that solid foundation figured out before you start working, which I had the basic story written, but not even 10% as much as I do these days in advance. Mm-hmm. It leads to things like the beginning has a chase sequence and this opening action sequence that takes 28 pages, but then some of the character development stuff is rushed because I didn't plot out exactly what would take how long. I just started going like, oh, and then this happens, and then the building blows up, and then the monsters come out of the gutter. And you kind of, I think as you mature, you realize that A, you'll remove a lot of the anxiety that comes from writing if you do the prep, if you have your work done ahead of time, if your homework is laid out. And B, the product is better. You know, the beats that every beat gets an equal amount of time, or if a beat needs a certain amount of time, if a story point needs a certain amount of time, you're not forced to cram it because you didn't plot your beats out and figure out the space. So I think that kind of stuff, there's a lot of just a lot of juvenile mistakes in the past that when I look back on some of that stuff, on the more serious things, I think a book like Blackheart Billy, which was supposed to be free form and fun and goofy, holds up perfectly. It's exactly, you know, what we intended it to be, and there is no traditional structure. The story is supposed to be just good fun, and that, by the way, has been colored recently.
Ooh, really? It got colored?
It has been colored, and I remastered it. Not George Lucas remastered, yes. But I mean
changed the ending.
Like, yeah. Yes. Blackheart, he shoots Greedo.
He's Heart of Gold Billy now.
At one point when he falls off a skateboard, he goes, no.
At the very end, yeah.
No, but that's cool, because I have the black and white version of it, and I love that book, and that was one of the ones I was wondering if you were ever going to go back to.
I couldn't, we've been working really hard on it for 6 months now with colorist Kevin Cross, who I've pulled in from the world of skateboard graphics. He worked for Deluxe.
Ooh, nice.
For a long time, and he's amazing. And I needed somebody who got the sensibility. He was in a lot of East Bay bands like Pitch Black and with Jesse Michaels of Op Ivy. He was in Big Rig and a couple other things. So he's, we lived together. We were old buddies, and he's great for this. And he's gone through and colored all 130 pages of all the miscellaneous Blackheart Billy stories that were ever done. And IDW is putting that out in October. It's already off the print. And
awesome.
Brand new Kieran Dwyer cover, and man, yeah, seeing that thing colored and getting the opportunity to fix all the little mistakes, I love that book. I really hope people will go out and give it a shot.
Cool. Yeah, no, I was a big fan of it, and you could tell him that I totally have the Big Rig 7-inch that came out like in 93 or 94.
Do you? Nice.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, you remember the black and white one with the heart and the truck on the cover? Yeah, look at that.
Jesse Michaels art on the front. Yeah, well, yeah. Kevin started that band, and anyway, so yeah, now he's coloring the Devil's Due thing I'm writing on based on the toy line, The Core. So I've roped him, and now he's firmly planted in the world of comic books. The poor bastard.
Cool. So you're writing something for Devil's Due?
Yeah. They've taken a toy line called The Core, and at first it was like, well, a toy line, but then when they said you can do whatever you want, I was like, okay, all right, yeah. I mean, getting
the core like Marine Corps or the core of the Earth.
The core like Marine Corps, yeah. Like there's a line of toys, and you might have seen them in Walmarts, and
I don't ever go in toy aisles. That's ridiculous. I'm a grown man.
Well, in Walgreens too. When you're on your way to get your shampoo to get rid of the crabs and whatnot, maybe you've taken the toy line to the Walgreens, the toy line of shame, so you didn't have to essentially make eye contact with
the topical scabies treatment is just down that aisle. So yeah,
nothing to do with the scabies or the crabs, but I still walk down the toy aisle in Walgreens and those things. I just look,
Oh, yeah. Proudly. I do too. Why not? I like to see what the kids are up to.
Yeah, exactly. So, see what variation of Star Wars figure I don't have.
Right, there you go. So, well,
it just got awkward, Ron.
Back away from the microphone.
Back away. So anyway, the core is a line of toys that started off about 20 years ago as sort of a faux G.I. Joe thing, and they've developed since, and they've become, because their price point's cheaper and they're basically the same, they sell a metric ton of the things, and... at first I took a military team and I was like, blah, 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 yeah. But then it's like, you can do whatever you want. And that kind of freedom is like, if you could do a G.I. Joe style book with no restraints and make it more PG-13. That's interesting. And so I've gotten into it, and we've already gotten underway. The first issue, the second issue are done. And,
are you going to do a silent issue for issue 29 and then in the 120s killer?
Only if I can get Mike Zeck and John Beatty to draw it.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, it would, but Mike Zeck will never do comic pages.
No, sadly. So anyway, so back to the whole comic business thing. At some point, you drew a line in the sand and you said you're going to do comics. Like, you were doing comics while you had a day job, right?
Yeah, I had been at Fox Animation for about 2 years when I recognized that I think that it might stem. It's not entirely stemming from ego, but there's a bit of ego in there where I feel, you know, I felt like at the time, and I was wrong, that I had a lot of great stories, and now I've wasted a lot of people's time trying to prove that for years. Self-deprecation.
But we don't buy it.
I did. You know, it's one of those things where you're reading comic books as a big. You know, I've always been a comic book, you know, fan, and it was actually Dan Klaus and Evan Dorkin and the New Movement and what was going on with Duncan Fegretto and Milligan and all those guys at Vertigo that got me inspired to do comics. Because frankly, at the time, let's face it, you know, we're talking 1993, 1994, 1995, you know, that era. Superhero books sucked balls.
Totally, yeah.
But they had awesome covers that were foil.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a garbage dump. You know, they had they had comics that you opened up and you'd hear a Foreigner song if you opened on page 7. Yeah, the comics were bad. So I found around 92. I think Tank Girl was my first
nice
entrance into the underground. And you know, growing up as a punker and as a, you know, in that scene as a kid, that was sort of a natural to find out. Like even at the time, to see somebody who was saying things that I was thinking, like Evan Dorkin was doing, you know, strips in various magazines that led me to Dork and Milk and Cheese and Hectic Planet and all that stuff. And that inspired me. It's the same way that other people were inspired. Like every single punk band was inspired by the Ramones. You know, you see somebody doing something that's like, you know, like I think when I read Dan Klaus's The Velvet Glove, Cast and Iron, I was like, well, this is like a David Lynch movie that I love, and mixed with this and that. And so for a while there, I tried very hard to copy, you know, Klaus and Dorkin, and recognized that like I kept going fantastical, like too fantastical, like my superhero roots, my pulp comic book roots sort of always crept in there. And I like to think that I've found a middle ground between the two in my work, up to present, where I've managed to do both. But anyway, working in animation, I didn't have an opportunity. I wanted to be doing this full time. You know, my brain has always spit out ideas. You know, every day I get like 6 new ideas that I have to like filter through. Like, no, okay, maybe. And it was happening even more rapid fire back then because I wasn't a drug addict.
Hadn't really taken hold of you yet, right?
Yeah, it hadn't. The heroin really slows down the upper, the higher brain, and it's wonderful. If you haven't tried it, they can't get it away from me. I love it. But the experience of working in animation was frustrating because you're working on something for years to perpetuate, like, you know, maybe 4 minutes of animation on something that you might not even give a shit about. Did I care about Anastasia? You know, fuck no, I didn't care about Anastasia. It turns out my wife loved the movie, and when I met her, I had something to talk to her about. And
nice score.
I got up all in that shit. But, I'm making the living, and everybody thinks that I'm doing great. And they're like, oh, you're working at Fox, you know, Rocky, oh, you're doing great. And like, yeah, you know, it's nice. I got a car, and I'm making money, but... Ultimately, it was like, look, I don't want to look back on a lifetime of moving around lines. I don't want to be in a situation where I was part of a team of 500 people to make some pappy, you know, piece of shit animated show or any of that stuff. And look, I mean, you know, that's just my opinion. Some people can do that and they enjoy it. For me, I want to tell stories that are personal. Like if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, you know, I got like 25 graphic novels I wrote. And those are mine and I did them how I wanted and I'm really proud
25
of them.
Graphic novels, 127 issues.
Okay, we got it. We see the
127
pattern.
25 graphic. I don't know if it's actually 25 graphic novels. I really don't.
Whatever. So, you have a fact sheet.
Someone will go count it. But
because I'm sitting on a throne made of them right now. 25 makes me valid.
So you say you want to do this, but it's and I know because we talk to a lot of fans, a lot of creators who are up and coming who are struggling with that. Well, I want to make comics, but I don't have the time and all that kind of stuff. And you talked earlier about how the more you did it, the more you learned from it. So you know, how hard was it to draw that line in the sand and say I'm just going to make comics now and make that my living, or can you become a comic creator without doing that?
Without
saying I'm quitting my job and I'm going to do comics now.
I stayed at Fox. I created the first 2 or 3 issues of Captain Dingleberry with some friends.
Nice, classy.
And we, basically I thought that, like, Captain Dingleberry was my attempt to take what I liked, you know, like, it'll be like this from the underground, but mixing in superhero stuff. It was right. There's some funny stuff in there, I guess, but it was mostly a misfire. But the idea behind it was, like, look, whatever the idea was, and it was just one of these things where we were doing Captain Dingleberry sketches, me and Harper and Rory and some of my buddies at Fox. We were doing Captain Dingleberry sketches at our lunch break because it would help us not want to shoot ourselves in the head from, you know, animating Anastasia's, you know, blush effect or whatever we were doing that week. And it just got to the point where it's like, you know, Sir Richard Pumpaloaf is, you know, he captures people, he turns them into bread, gingerbread men, and he rapes them. And if you let that idea go to waste, then the whole world is going to collapse.
I think we're both in shock from that idea.
You blew
my mind.
That's
how powerful that idea was.
So Richard Pumpaloaf is a Frank Zappa song, and that was Harper's idea. And we came up with Sack Warrior of Chode, and that's in Blackheart Billy. He started in Captain Dingleberry. He has nuts made of titanium and a sack made of silly putty, and he uses it like Thor's hammer, and he hits people with it. It wasn't, like, obviously it's ridiculous, and that was the idea.
How did you end up on Booster Gold?
Yeah. Sack Warrior of Chode is going to make a guest appearance in issue 14, by the way.
Nice.
Well, but I love all that stuff, and that's the point I was getting at with this, is that, like, we were doing these books, and it just became clear to me that, like, look, I want to do this. I want to get good at this, and I think that anybody, you don't have to just quit your day job. For me, it was something where I did a couple of the issues before I left Fox. We had a couple in the can, and issue one of Captain Dingleberry sold 5,000 copies or something, which to us was like, you know, it's a black and white book that we self-published.
Wow.
We're like, we're gonna do great, and off we went. And we did like 8 issues of the thing, you know, we just me and Harper and Rory sitting in, you know, Harper and I quit, Rory kept his job, and we did 8 issues, and once you do that much, you get the bug. And this is a point where, you know, we were co-writing it, co-penciling it, co-inking it, co-doing the Zip-A-Tones. This is when you still cut Zip-A-Tone out with film and an X-Acto knife to get any, you know, tones on there, because, you know, in 1997, 98, you know, your computer could barely handle an email. So we did all that stuff by hand, and it was the DIY spirit. It was like, hey, we're just buddies making a comic because we want to. And, you know, we got tired of it. It was juvenile. We had fun with it. And I moved to San Francisco, and Kieran and I started doing Blackheart Billy. And from there, I just started doing more and more books. I think that for me, the road, you know, was a longer one because I was also jumping back and forth between day jobs. I think it was Brian Vaughn or somebody had a line about comic books is like a castle and no two people sneak in the same way. So
yeah.
Whenever there's anybody who's looking for a piece of advice on how to get into comics, the only advice I have is just shut the fuck up and make a lot of comic books, because, you know, I made a metric ton of graphic novels that didn't make me a dime. I was working a full-time job storyboarding at Electronic Arts, while I was penciling Man with the Screaming Brain at Dark Horse, while I was writing Nightmare at IDW, Sea of Red at Image, Fear Agent at Image, and Strange Girl at Image. I was working, and I did that for years. I worked like an animal just to make it all work. And if you want it, that's maybe what you have to do. Some people don't. Some people do one book, and it's astounding, and it takes off, and they're hired to make a bunch of money. My road was one of tenacity, where I had to just put my head down and go, look, I'm going to make the books I want to make. I'm going to do the very best I can to keep them ongoing, which is also a very difficult task opposed to just doing a 4 or 5 issue mini. And here, you know, a couple, 4 or 5 years later, I've got, you know, Fear Agent inching towards issue 25, and, you know, we did 20 issues of Strange Girl and blah, blah, blah. Managed to get a couple few good runs of these things done.
Has it only been 25 issues of Fear Agent? It feels like more. I realize there's only, what, like 3 trades or whatever, but still.
The fourth trade came out 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And then we've got the Tales of the Fear Agent trade. So there's 5 trades, and then we've got the next Tales of the Fear Agent trade coming out. So there's a good, you know, there's a good quantity of stuff there. But yeah, there was a big break between the jump between Image and Dark Horse, and then, you know, let's be frank, Jerome and Tony, both amazing. You know, Tony can be late sometimes with pages. I know.
Shocking.
Shocking. And, you know, but the book lags in its scheduling, and people get upset about that. I understand. But, I mean, my options are to what, you know? To say, hey, Tony, you have to take off, and then the last 3 issues of the arc are drawn by somebody else. You know, in the case of the Hatchet Job, we brought in Kieran Dwyer to help out to do breakdowns for Jerome Pena, but the book still looked the same, and Kieran's amazing, so it didn't hurt. But I don't know. For me, it's like I'd rather look back in a year and have Eye Against Eye be all of Tony Moore, and it shipped late, and some people were bummed out that it didn't come out as frequently as it could have, than have, you know, thrown in three or four other guys to help bang it out just to make the monthly. But, you know, that's sort of the prerogative of the creator own on this stuff, and it does hurt the sales, and it does hurt the confidence with the retailers. But Tony can work at the speed he can work at, and that's what it is.
Well, it seems like with Furious and specifically, you've been trying to figure out how to crack the code of, you know, a successful creator owned comic book, be it, you know, doing a, you know, having it be an ongoing, but having the arcs clearly delineated, know it's like part one of six, and then have that easily be identifiable to collect it in a trade, or having the artists, you know, swap arcs, you know, which I assume is a way to allow the artists to get the work done somewhat ahead of time. Is that the case, or am I just reading way too much?
You're obviously doing everything you can. Like, look, nobody, we're past the days, like, when you want to work with somebody who's as talented as Jerome Pena or Tony Moore, those guys aren't going to hit 22 pages a month, you know, all the time. Now, Jerome is much closer these days than Tony, but Tony's also juggling a few projects, I think, right, at once. The reality comes down to, like, look, you know, from the get-go, you know, Tony isn't comfortable trying to do, you know, X, Y, and more than X amount of pages a month, and he knows that. And so, you know, we had a conversation about it, and he said, like, we should probably consider alternating art teams. And for a time there, it was going to be Corey Walker, and then Corey couldn't do it. And fortunately, in my time teaching at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco, I came into contact with the sketchbooks of Jerome Pena, and a studio mate of mine at the time knew him and put us in touch, and Jerome hopped on. And it's kind of perfect. If you get two guys like Tony and Jerome, two A-list badasses, to switch off every four and five issues, you can keep a fairly regular schedule while keeping the book looking, you know, really sharp. Mm-hmm. And so that was definitely something that we, you know, had set out to do. And it's worked for the most part.
It's totally worked. I think, I mean, it's great. So, I mean, you've read us gush about it on ifanboy.com, and I think it allows the artists to, it gives you enough of, they're similar enough to be it familiar, but different enough to make it interesting with each arc.
So. Sure, yeah, and I think that, and they both bring different things that are great to the book. And as for the, when we moved to Dark Horse, we did Last Goodbye. If you look on the inside front cover, it says issue, you know, 12 in a series, and 13 and 14, and et cetera. But on the cover, it just had the miniseries numbering. I thought that would be enough so people knew where it fell in continuity. You know, so people who had bought the first 11 issues at Image or the first two trades would go, oh, they would open the inside front cover and see this is issue 13. But we got a lot of mail from people who didn't know. They're like, well, it goes back to when he was on Earth, and I don't know where it falls. And I realized that, like, you know, just because I know the story like the back of my hand, I need to clarify these things. And you had two types of systems. You had the Hellboy BPRD, where everything is told in a series of minis, and then you have ongoing. And I was, you know, it seemed like an easy choice to me and Dave and everybody at Dark Horse. Why not do both? Why not tell them, hey, this is issue 17 ongoing. It's issue one of six in the new arc. And it's worked out great. We had some, you know, upset retailers at the beginning because there was a solicitation snafu, which I totally understand. I mean, you know, I've retailed as well. I managed a store for 2-3 years. I know that any sort of
jobs.
Yeah, I spent 10 years as a hobo moving.
I was crab fishing in Alaska. The whole time I was dreaming of Booster Gold arcs.
Right. Yeah. Instead of painting a fence, I'd be like, "You need those comics bagged and boarded and priced? I can grade silver and gold." and I did it all for a biscuit.
Delicious.
But anyway, yeah. So, I mean, and that was a, you know, it's a risk. We realized it was a risk, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of anally attentive collectors who are like, no, I don't know what happened. Like, you know what happened. You know, like, the inside ongoing numbering is now also on the cover with the mini numbering. And the nice thing is, though, that I've had more people come up to me, like fans, readers at shows, and via email tell me, this is great, because I love BPRD, but sometimes I'll miss I'll miss going to the shop for 3 months, and I don't know what arc falls where in continuity. And, you know, like, I obviously think, like, well, you could, you know, look online for 2 seconds or look at the spine of the trades and figure that out. But I think that this kind of gives you the best of both worlds.
Do you, when you're writing for either of those artists, do you sort of tailor the story for that artist? Or like, or if you come up with an idea, do you think this would be better for Jerome to do, this would be better for Tony to do?
I don't know. Tony Taylor. I know that Jerome was doing such great work on the beginning of Hatchet Job that I started getting frustrated. I would come up with these intricate, crazy scenarios that nobody should be able to illustrate in a comic book page in 5 panels, where Keith is riding a goldfish, does a Rockford, flies towards another goldfish, jumps from one goldfish onto the other goldfish, knocks the dude off the other goldfish, turns around just in time to realize he's about to go smack dab into a tree, jumps over the branch, grabs a vine, spins around, and then re-lands back on the goldfish of one of the other enemies. And I was like, you're fucked. Okay, there you go, buddy. Because, like, no way can you draw that. And I honestly think in the back of my head I was setting him up to, like, go, there's no way you can do that. That's too hard. But, man, he not only did it, but it's one of the best sequences in any book I've ever done.
It's funny because you just described it, and I was remembering it. You actually described the actual scene. You weren't making that up.
No, that's an actual scene, yeah.
Yeah, I know.
And Jerome, and that's right after he fights the giant flower that yep. he ate his buddy. You know, if you take enough acid and shoot enough PCP into your eyeballs, and you can do that. You can get liquid PCP now. I know everybody's like, oh, you got to smoke it. Fuck that. Shoot it into your eye. You get high.
That's hardcore.
And that's really what it's all about. All of this is just window dressing.
Yeah, I mean... Later. I figured I read a few things that Grant Morrison wrote about, you know, his dabbling with drugs, and I was already, you know, heavily into the drug culture, and just said to myself, fuck it, you know what, you wanna go crazy, let's go crazy.
I don't even know, I was gonna make some sort of, you know, Americans do it harder, but I couldn't even do it, so it's just...
No, yeah, and we do.
So in issue exactly 12...
I was like, oh, you think you're so great. And P.S., he is so great. We love him. I was actually just looking at the... have you guys seen the Superman 3D?
I did, yeah.
I haven't read it, but I was just looking through it. Man, that Doug Mankey and Christian Ellenie, what a team, huh?
The 3D was actually alarmingly effective.
It's great.
No, yeah. Normally when I see 3D, I go, oh, come on, whatever. But I was like, whoa, this is actually pretty good. So
yeah. Now this is, and these guys are the best. I mean, come on, Grant Morrison, yeah. Doug Mankey, and Christian Ellenie. It's like three of the best guys in comics. I can't wait.
Yeah, totally in their wheelhouse. It's good. It's a good issue. So. All right, but back to Fear Agent. So
you've got
Grant Morrison.
We can if you want. Apparently, he went to Alpha Centauri.
I want to talk about me.
So you've got a book like Fear Agent. I mean, like. How do you as a creator go about promoting that book if you don't have – I mean, you don't have a ton of resources for doing it, and obviously it's really important to keep that alive. Like, what is it that you do as a creator to make sure that people know about it?
I there's nothing – you know what? I mean, for a long time I dedicated every Sunday of every week to doing internet stuff, where I would do an interview with somebody or write an article for Newsarama or something to keep pounding away at it, and it makes no difference. I mean, I still do the viral marketing. I focus on the people who enjoy the stuff. I don't try to convert people who don't. I don't have the energy for it. You know, the people who read Fear Agent really respond to it, and they seem to love it. And that's all we could ask. You know, do we need 3,000 or 4,000 more readers on the monthly book? Yeah. Are we going to get them? No. It's not going to happen. You look at Casanova, Fear Agent, Scalped, Criminal. Those four books, and I hate to throw one of my own books in there because it sounds, you know, I guess it sounds a little bit arrogant, but I like.
No, I mean, it's
like,
a good book, but it's no Scalp. Let's be honest.
God, how dare you? I will take that. I will take Jason Aaron on in a fight. He thinks he's an Alabama corn snake with that sweet goatee. I'll beat his ass and with a typewriter, a giant old school typewriter.
That would be the classic way to do it.
There's an old birchwood.
You know, Jason Aaron's not even a dude. He doesn't. He has two sets of woman's genitals in his pants.
Oh, God.
What do you think about a writer who has two sets of
women? It comes out in the pages of Scalped. I think you could see if you read in between the panels.
So that's a clearly dual vagina
Scalped,
work.
I only bring up Scalped because I do think it's brilliant. I think that it's also completely unique, like Casanova and like Criminal in comics and like Fear Agent. you know, hard-boiled crime, sort of psychedelic fun spy action. You know, I guess Criminal and Scalped are both sort of hard-boiled crime. And then you know, science fiction, horror, war, Western, whatever Fear Agent is this month.
Is that how you describe it? This science fiction, horror, war, pulp.
Yeah, I don't, you know, well, that's the, you know, I there's the commerce side of my brain, which I have my log line and my pitch, you know, and I have also got the other part where it's like, if you can boil it down to a sentence, you're missing the heart of the thing.
Nice.
I don't know. Anyway, the thing I was getting at though is that the numbers on all those books range from, you know, 5,000 to, you know, 14,000. Obviously, Criminal selling, you know, double than the rest. But the fact that Criminal, you know, it doesn't sell 50,000, and the fact that Scalped doesn't sell 50,000, and Casanova and Fear Agent, and they're not going to. You have to. We've all come to terms that, like, you know, we've got plans to try and cross promote and do things where, you know, I've talked with Jason and Matt about trying to get our fans to jump from one to the other, and it's worked a little bit. But the industry is what it is right now, and that you know, the trades do great. We've sold 14,000, you know, Fear Agent volume ones and 10 volume twos and, you know, 5 volume threes, and it's only been out for a little while. The trades do great. The same with Scalped and Casanova, and the trades help keep the books alive, basically. But there's no amount of promotion, like how I go about keeping people aware of the book. Mm-hmm. I just do the book the best I can. And mention it when I talk to people. But anything else, I don't know if there's anything that I can say to somebody, given that I'm the writer. This book I made is so good. And you know what's good? My book. Come read it. Everybody likes my book. But, you know what I mean, though? When you read people self-promoting, you're like, hey, man, I get you got to self-promote. And I've done a ton of it. But it's kind of sucky.
Doing it right now.
But
I'm pretending that I'm not. This is the ploy. I really wish you wouldn't have said that.
We pull the curtain back. That's what we do.
But
it's a little fat man playing with himself.
but it's interesting because, you know, Fear Agent is creator owned, right? You own every piece of it, right? I assume, or do you share ownership with Tony and Jerome, or?
Yeah, well, Tony and I and Jerome all have ownership stake and back end stake. Yeah,
cool.
So
it's a creator owned book, but you are published by Dark Horse, which is, you know, one of the smaller publishers, but it's the biggest of the smallest publishers. So as a you know, like, there's got to be some level of, you know, onus on them to promote the book as well, because they're in it too, right?
Yeah, and they have. I mean, like, yeah. You know, when the new arc came out, they do banner. Well, what can they do?
You know, it kind of like what avenues does a publisher and a creator and who's doing a creator own book have to get the word out these days? You know, I mean, that's really the question.
I don't know. I mean, like, you know, Dark Horse got us the cover of previews for Fear Agent, The Last Goodbye. We had a double page ad soliciting all four trades and the new Eye Against Eye arc with a variant sketch Tony Moore cover. I mean, at a certain point, you realize that there's just nothing you can do. You just make your book, you know. Fortunately, it's one of those books that's loved by enough people, and Dark Horse has you know, really put their money where their mouth is to keep supporting it, to keep the book alive. And but sales-wise, until a big movie is announced or something, at which point we might get a 30 Days of Night boost. I don't think that we can do anything. I think we just make a really good comic book that we sit back and go, hey, you know what? I'm really proud of this, and that's all you get.
Right. Is that book secure for the time being? Like,
it's definitely going to make it to issue 32. Beyond that, I don't know.
What issue are we on now?
20. Let's see. Tony's 24 is at the printer. Tony's working on 25.
Okay, so there's still a couple of months of ordering in there, because I'm going to be very selfish now, and everyone needs to buy it because I want to read it beyond issue 32. So you know, so like it's not into like, oh, well, you know, da da da. It's one of, I mean, Josh picked it as the pick of the week a couple of weeks ago, right? I mean, I'm not
that's
alone.
That's literally why we're talking to you, because we want more people to read the book, so that we don't lose it.
And look, guys, I mean, like, the, you know, if you bring on 200, 300 new readers, that's so helpful. You don't know, and I appreciate the fact that you guys not only, you know, enjoy the comic book, but you actively go out and promote it. And I know that, you know, I know it has an effect. I mean,
it's just
other ways that we're awesome.
we have a we have a video show that everyone should watch. but what I think is just interesting about Fear Agent is that a testament to it is that, you know, at least from our point of view, you know, Josh, Connor, and myself, you know, we all like comics. We're all very good friends. Very rarely do we have a comic that crosses over all three circles in the Venn diagram. And Fear Agent is one of the few that does it. And that was what made me stop and look, because wait a minute, like, I like it, he likes it, he likes it. We never agree. So either something's really wrong about the book or something's really right about it.
Well, that's nice to hear. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate it. It means a lot to me. And, you know, it's nice to read nice things about your work. A lot of the time we all have, you know, rules about not checking out reviews online. And so for the most part, we try not to. It's because even, you know, if there's a theory that even if you accept the good, you also have to accept the bad, and it's all sort of anecdotal, you know, it's all sort of, it's all perspective, it's all people's opinions, you know, and ultimately if you ingest that, you can start even subconsciously pandering or changing your work to fit the mold of some reviewer who has a blog, who might be, 7,000-pound, sweaty half-wit from, you know, Flampington Rack and Zacklin, in Imaginaryville, you know, backwoods USA. I don't know, but I mean, the point that I'm getting at is that, you work in a vacuum. You get no feedback, and so when you guys have great podcasts and great reviews, and when people you actually respect who are doing a lot to, you know, further and promote the comics they enjoy have something nice to say, it's nice.
Do you really try to avoid reading anything online about your books, or?
Yeah, I go to great lengths. I slip. You know, it's 3 a.m. sometimes.
And just you're drunk, and it's just
accidentally Google Fear Agent review.
Sure, you do the ego search. How do you not? Because, like, you know, it feeds into the vacuum. You know, your friends read the books, you know, to help you out with scripts. Like, we all share scripts and bounce ideas around and try and, you know, give each other sounding boards. But at some point, you're putting all this time and energy into a comic that you feel good about. It goes out into the world, and, you know, there might be 4 or 5 reviews or, you know, 10 reviews out there online, and it does itch at you sometimes to find out what do those people think.
Right.
And, you know, you slip and you'll read it, and, you know, it's funny because you'll read 7 good, great reviews, glowing paragraphs of, you know, what you did right, and you're like, okay, and then you'll hit that one where it's like, you know, some broken English, you know, I think this comic misses, you know, the review makes no valid points that you agree with, and it's vitriolic and it's snide, and it's the kind of people you don't really care if they like the book or not, but somehow that's the one that sticks with you. Right. You know, like, so it's better to just not do it.
Well, I mean, showing the—I definitely couldn't showing the restraint to, you know, to not have a Google alert set to your name and go off and be checking it every 5 minutes. Like, I've got respect if you're able to hold back from that. So,
I'm not gonna lie. I got a Google alert. It still pops up, and occasionally I'll scan. That's actually the only thing that I do regularly is it'll scan and say, you know, there's 17 new things about the End League, and I'll go, yeah, and I'll scan them and go, all right, better, you know, whatever. Good, 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 bad, bad, good, bad, good, bad, bad, good, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, speaking of the End League, good segue there. Thanks, Rick. So the most recent issue just came out last week with and had split art between the previous penciler.
Yeah, Matt Matten, yep. And Eric Canetti.
Yep.
And then Eric Canetti did his first sequence. And I've got issue 5, Canetti's first issue, went to print this week. And I will, I'll send you guys some JPEGs, and you can put them up on the site, because it's
cool.
Fucking astounding. I mean, if you read the book in the past and didn't dig it, if you do dig the book, either way, as of issue 5, this thing is A-list. It's as good as I can make a comic. And working with somebody like Canetti, who is an absolute genius, basically left his job on Ben 10 at Cartoon Network and to come do this, and he has been pouring himself into it. And man, issue 5, I put my name behind that. I couldn't be prouder of anything I've worked on.
Yeah, so up to this point, with the first arc kind of behind you or whatever, have you been, I mean, are you satisfied with the End League experience so far? Or are you, obviously you're excited to work with Eric Canetti to move on, but that first arc was a little rocky.
It was a little rocky, yeah. in a few places. You know, what do I do? Do I start going into, like, you know,
no.
The process and how it broke down and potentially didn't work?
Yeah.
I think that what it serves as is a really great setup for what's coming. And, yeah. You know, beyond that, I'm still proud of it. I still think that there's good stuff in there. But I think ultimately what that first trade will do, what I hope it'll do, is serve as a really nice setup for what's coming with Eric and I.
You gelled really well with Eric Gwynn, and you're going to work with him again on a new book called Gigantic?
Yes. Yeah. Just got the second cover in from him, which is phenomenal. And
I haven't heard about this project at all. So tell me about it.
Well, it's built off of the standpoint of, or from the idea that Earth was created as a giant reality television show, and humans were also built by committee by executives in the UBC, the Universal Broadcast Company, and because we're just smart enough to make fancy weapons. And we're just savage and dumb enough to use them. And so, every bit of our personalities comes down to drama and conflict. And we've been perfectly built to make good television. And based on that idea, I came up with this character who is part of another. He's a former human who was abducted and taken off. Because Earth is such a popular show, they would abduct humans who were popular to go have their own shows. And this guy was abducted, and he was turned into a gladiator in these extravagant ultimate fighting style arenas that is another very popular show. And eventually escapes and wants to return to Earth to tell everybody to break free of what's going on. There's invisible cameras everywhere. You know, like right now around your room, there's 15 invisible tiny little UFOs filming you. And you have your own channel that one of, 1,700 trillion aliens could be watching. And he wants to break Earth free. He thinks it's a travesty and an ugly thing. And when he arrives on Earth, he basically has the power to grow the character, and he wears this armor, this organic armor that's bonded to him. And as he absorbs kinetic energy, he grows bigger and bigger. And when he hits a certain size, he basically discharges the energy in a mass explosion. So he'll grow to like 60, 70 feet, and then boom, blow up, and then revert back down to 10 feet, which is a kind of a pain in the ass power. It works really well if you're in an arena and you're fighting a bunch of guys, and as you grow and grow and grow, you eventually have your critical mass and detonate, and then they have to deal with that. Now it sounds like I'm playing D&D. If you roll your arm, that's 70.
It kind of did.
Well, first of all, if you're fighting in the arena, yay! but this is hopefully what I'm achieving in the comics is a mix between something that's got a hooky idea that might not be necessarily standard mainstream fare, and something that does dial into a kid who grew up on superhero books playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. Right. So who's publishing it?
Oh, that's Dark Horse.
Okay, cool. Awesome.
And it's an ongoing?
That is, we're going to do that one BPRD style because we don't know. Eric is in demand, and my schedule is filling as well. So what we're going to do is the first arc is a self-contained story that leaves things wide open for the next. And then we'll get to that once our schedules are open and just do it sort of, do a mini series whenever we can come back and do it.
Cool.
And when's that out?
First issue is November.
Enough with all your artsy fartsy indie books.
Yes.
People really want to know about The Punisher from what I understand.
People?
That's apparently what the kids are into is The Punisher. I don't know. But are you co-writing with Matt Fraction now? And when did co-writing become the in thing to do for the big Marvel books?
It is so hip. It's scary.
It is so hip. It's scary. Well, I think you get a better book a lot of the times out of it. And in the case of Jigsaw, I think that I was really proud of what Matt and I did. I think we had a big story, and it worked out well. I think Chaykin did a great job on it. it's also something, two heads are often better than one, and Matt and I are good friends, and we write really well together, so it made sense. And the same with him and Ed, and in a lot of cases, it's like, look, we all use our writer friends as sounding boards anyway. A lot of the time when you're stuck, you call your buddy and you go, hey, so, Slim Jim walks into a bar, he's got a shotgun and a dead koala bear. What do I do with the koala bear? And your buddy will maybe have an idea. But as for why, I think that it comes down to, it's fun. It's something where I enjoy it. If you're working with somebody who you have stuff in common with, then you're you're ping-ponging ideas back and forth, and you get a synergy going, and things get exciting.
With a character like the Punisher, though, I mean, like that who's been at times really badass and really awesome, and at times a caricature of himself.
Yeah.
You know, like so. I mean, did you 10 years ago, where you're like, I'm going to write Punisher War Journal someday? Or like...
Well, you know what? That first Punisher miniseries with Mike Zeck was one of my absolute favorite things as a kid. And I mean, I was at the age where when the first Grant and Zeck and Beatty miniseries came out, the Punisher was always this peripheral sort of guy who was just around to shoot at a brown person and have Spider-Man or Daredevil kick his ass.
Yep.
You know, that was his job. And at this point, all of a sudden, this mini comes out, and I had never given a shit about the character. I was like 12 or 13 when it came out, and it's got this guy with two giant handguns being thrown back into a bunch of trash in a dilapidated alley from the thrust of just blasting at something. And it's like such a captivating image that you have to know more. And as it turns out, that first issue is astounding. It's great. You know, it's the Punisher in jail, surviving in jail with people trying to kill him. He's got no weapons. He's got none of his arsenal. He has to escape the jail. Jigsaw's in jail. I mean, it's good comic books. I really was a big fan of it. I can't attest to that, to everything thereafter. There were some shining moments, and I read all the Microchip stuff with, I read the Klaus Janson stuff. And there was a lot of good stuff to be mined from all of that. I think, like everybody says, there's no bad character. There's just bad writers. You know, you can find a good way to take any type of, you have a character who's described as X, Y, and Z, if you're any good, you can find a way to make that work. And the Punisher is challenging because he, at the end of the day, is a murderer. He kills people, but he's also like he's a perfect force of nature. He's pure in his motivations at the same time. And getting into a character's headspace where, you know, he's black or white. You know, he's almost like Rorschach. He's like the perfect Ayn Rand sort of, you know, Fountainhead character where, you know, if you're good or bad, and if you're bad, I'm going to kill you. You know, he's kind of crazy. He's broken. Like the death of his family hit a switch, and now he just goes around, and because there's an endless supply of criminals out there, he's going to go kill them all. And that's Frank Castle. And I think at that point it comes down to figuring out what situations you put him in that test those limits and test the sort of integrity of his mission, as well as the inherent sort of flaws in it and how he reacts to seeing those.
I'm gonna be honest, and you just blew my mind by comparing the Punisher to Ayn Rand. because I'm an Ayn Rand fan, and it's, you're totally right. I'd never thought of it that way, and that's wow. I'm impressed.
That was the only way I could get my head into it, and I think that one thing that Matt and I wanted to do as well is, you know, there's little moments in the Jigsaw thing that it's interesting to me that if it's not just straight up action or shit happening, that people there had been some people, and again, this is my assholeness checking a review online, who are upset that you got to see a day in the life of Frank when he's going out to buy the Tiger Ball. Frank takes Tiger Ball powder? Come on. And, you know, he's dealing with the Patton Oswalt and Brian Posehn pair who run the little hop shop down on the street. But for me, that's what I really want to see more of that. I mean, I know that you want to get into gunfights, but I also want to see how this guy lives. The guy who lives in his van and murders people he considers criminals, like, that actually is pretty interesting. Like,
What's he doing for the 20 hours of the day?
Right. You work out. You know, it's kind of like he's in his own prison. The world is Frank's prison, and he doesn't allow himself any contact. And that was the other great thing about what I really felt strong about the Jigsaw arc that we did, is that you see anybody who's connected to Frank, the guy he buys the Tiger Ball powder from, anyone Frank has contact with, if that's ever seen by the wrong people, that person's going to die. So Frank is like a walking, he is, that skull on his chest is symbolic for a lot of different things. And it's going to be really interesting in the coming stuff that we have coming up in Secret Invasion and then beyond, to sort of explore those for me.
Right. I mean, because it's interesting. The Punisher as a character, I mean, we've talked about it a lot on the podcast where, like, you know, we've felt as he's one of those characters who, in our opinion, has been more powerful as a secondary character, as a backup character. Like, when he pops up in the last page of Daredevil, it's like, oh, shit, Frank's in town, you know, like, but it's, you know, to see the book that is dedicated to him and what Ennis has been doing in the Max title, I think, is different than what you and Fraction have been doing in War Journal, but I think are both good executions of the character, exploring different aspects of the idea of this madman, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, and it's great that Matt set such a different tone with War Journal, and I'm gonna continue that tone. That, look, you can't outdo Garth. You can't do Garth. You know, Garth is Garth. And Garth is doing a Max book with the Punisher, which is perfect. And, you know, if you're going to do Frank and hard-boiled crime with, you know, X-rated situations,
right.
That gets to a really, it gets to a core of what, you know, ultimately you like to see Frank and where the new film is progressing and where those things go. But the other turn, the left turn, is taking him into a place like the Marvel Universe where it's a little more fantastic, where you've got people with superpowers and you've got Iron Man flying around and, you know, potentially Galactus. And I think it was Fraction who said, or maybe it was Axel, somebody, I was trying to get my head around Frank, and somebody said, Galactus lands, all Frank thinks is I need a bigger gun. And I liked it. Immediately I was like, I like Frank Castle. Let's go write comics.
Well, it's like, who was talking? I mean, were you involved in, and forgive me, there's just so many comics, but the Frank, the Punisher Secret Invasion tie-in?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, and
we just finished 25, which is a double-sized issue.
Right, and that seems to be like the best scenario for Frank Castle, right?
It couldn't be better. I mean, because we get to deal with things that have been happening with him, you know, in the last 24 issues. Dealing with Clark and dealing with some of the other characters that he's had contact with, like Bridge and some of the other people, some of the other cast members, it's all coming to a head. All these things that Matt has put into motion are taking place, and at the same time, it's in the backdrop of a Skrull invasion. So you're running down the street having a confrontation or an altercation with, you know, with a buddy of yours, and all of a sudden there's a Skrull sniper from, you know, a mile down the road, you know, picking people off. We got to create our own Super Skrull. You know, when we got to a point in the story where it made natural sense, where we realized, you know, based on how the Skrulls are operating, the Skrulls they've had people on Earth forever, and they're trying to figure out, look, you know, how do we just go in and invade, kick ass, and be done with this thing? And they would take care of guys, you know, like Thor, and they would have Super Skrulls for the X-Men and all these other big heavy hitters. They would definitely have Super Skrulls as well to take care of street-level guys like... Mm-hmm. Take care of guys like, you know, Daredevil, Spider-Man, Moon Knight, Frank Castle. If you're going to take care of, you know, you got to take care of everybody. And so we got to devise our own Super Skrull, who's a street level guy. This was a Super Skrull who was sent to take care of anybody who might not be like a god level power, but has proven themselves in the past to be somebody to not be taken, you know, lightly.
Cool. That's gonna be cool to make your own Super Skrull. I mean, that's kind of a
yeah, it was a blast.
You can't use Colossus with the Banshee because that's been done.
Right. Well, I guess it doesn't matter. I don't know if I never know if I should give away what the Super Skrull is or leave it for when people buy the book and get the reveal.
Save it. Yeah, save it for the reveal. I mean, we spoil too many things that much, but you know.
Yeah.
But that's very, very cool. So awesome. So And you're also working. You're working for DC in addition to working for Marvel, the Punisher War Journal. You're doing Booster Gold.
I'm doing a 2-issue arc of Booster Gold, where Starro, everybody should know Starro by now. Come on,
Starro.
Face hugging starfish.
Yep.
Love Starro. Starro takes over Rip Hunter and starts going through history and spreading Starro spores everywhere so that he can conquer the world, which is his goal because he started with a conqueror. He can conquer the world without having to fight a bunch of superhumans.
Nice, he's a lazy conqueror.
He's a lazy conqueror. Well, nothing else has worked. He's been trying since you know the JLA did form to fight him. I mean, he is Starro.
He's just tired now.
First showed the Justice League. They fought Starro.
Yep.
It's a bit of nerd trivia there. Come on.
Yeah, I remember the cover. They made a statue out of that cover as well, too. Oh, man, I'm a nerd. How about that? So.
And so that's been an absolute blast. My dream team on that was Pat Olaf and Jerry Ordway, which, man, those are two A-lists, you know, scientists of technical town. And the first issue is done and is so gorgeous, man. Pat Olaf with Ordway on top of him inking him is just the perfect team. It's perfect. Perfect, perfect, perfect. I'm a writer. It's perfect. Adjective. Adjective. Yeah, and that's a ton of fun. We get to basically explore a past and a future that have been taken over by Starro, and you know, in all of the different sort of problems that are caused by Booster solving one, and you know, time travel is complicated stuff. But man, I love it. I love writing time travel stories.
Yeah, time travel. I mean, the why I love Booster Gold. I'm more of a Marvel guy than a DC guy, but I love Booster Gold this incarnation because to me it's like Quantum Leap in the DC universe, which is a blast. So.
Yeah, it's a perfect hook. Yeah. I mean, what the Jeffs came up with is for their hook. I mean, it couldn't be better. It's basically a guy who has to go through time fixing all of the damage, you know, caused by all the crises that have been happening over the last whatever
20 years. Yeah,
20 years. Well, yeah, and he has to fix all of these small infinitesimal little problems that are caused, and big ones, and all the things that he has to learn about, you know, how things work in the time stream, which is nice to see defined in the DC universe. And he has to still be considered a buffoon and a giant egotistical jerk by everybody. So he's basically saving the universe, and everyone thinks he's a douchebag.
So it doesn't really feel so much like you're cleaning up Geoff Johns' mess as if he left you all of this stuff to work with, I guess.
You know, it wasn't a mess at all. I think that what he did was he set up a perfect comic book.
Right.
You know, you've got Rip Hunter, who's in charge of things, and he's got a lot of secrets, and he's a time master. He knows what's going on. I'm bringing in the Kronoses, Lady Kronos, who I introduced in my Atom run, and Kronos himself, another couple time masters who get involved in this thing. It's great because you think about all the time travel characters in the DC universe, and now there's a book where they all kind of naturally plug in. So it was two of the most fun issues I've ever written.
You're all over the place with this stuff. Like, none of these projects that we've talked about sound anything alike, and like, you're doing almost like what are opposite books at Marvel and DC. I mean, Booster Gold is as far from Punisher War Journal.
It's steeped in continuity. Yeah.
And I mean, how do you avoid being typecast like that? Because you seem to be doing a really good job with it.
You, I think, just do a lot of different books. I mean, coming up from creator-owned, you have an opportunity to define yourself. And I think that I've managed to define myself as somebody who likes all kinds of genres. And, I, you know, when people say, I don't like science fiction, I go, guess what, stupid superheroes? That's just science fiction. that fucking guy you're reading, the atomic guy who lifts buildings, science. I don't like it in space. Oh, but you like Green Lantern? Love Green Lantern.
But he's a superhero. Well,
check it out. You might like science fiction. I don't understand. I mean, because genre is just trappings. It's just a fun dressing to put on a good story. Mm. If it's a Western or whatever, you know. I mean, you look at. I was reading some screenplay stuff last night, and they were comparing the structure of Aaron Brockovich with Gladiator, and it's exactly the same structure. It's exactly the same structure. Everything happens at the same time: the reveals, the twist,
wow,
the big final push, the conclusions. And a lot of movies are like that. I mean, in a sense, that foundation becomes formulaic. And I was actually just talking with Fraction about this, about, you know, do you use the formulaic approach, or do we, as comic book guys, because we have freedom, you know, completely digress from that? And I like to try. I'm going to try and implement a little bit of both. I've mostly been going by instinct so far, and the more I read about structure, the more I'm curious is if I did adhere to, like, let's say a film structure, let's say the structure of Gladiator on an arc of Punisher. I'm not saying I'm doing that, but I'm saying it's an interesting idea to explore. You know, if you did. Structure a comic book arc that same way. But I think that the way you avoid being typecast is just to do a lot of different stuff and hopefully do it well. You know, I mean, I started off doing mostly horror books and a skate punk comic book, you know. Sea of Red and Doll and Creature, definitely, you know, sort of like Blade Runner meets horror in one, and pirates and vampires in the other. And then from there, you just explore doing stuff that you dig, I guess, you know.
So you came up doing creator own work, and this the big two company work has been within the past year or so of actually working for Marvel and DC, with all the brouhaha around creator own work and, you know, and Robert Kirkman and all that kind of stuff. I mean, like, you know, are you trying to prove Kirkman wrong, or where do you net out on this whole kind of debate?
Oh man, I take the fifth. I remain silent. Robert's great. He's had a wonderful. I don't want to say luck. He writes good books. You know, The Walking Dead. At the end of the day, it's lightning in a bottle with any of this stuff. Well, you know, are Peter Laird and Kevin Eastman going to sit around and say, "Hey, I made $1 jillion off the Turtles. You should too." And people are like, "Why? Well, I don't know if that happens to everybody who does a creator-owned book." I think Robert's intentions are good and they're in the right place. He thinks that, and he makes, obviously I don't disagree with him. It's a valid point. Everybody should do creator-owned books. Should they right now march out of their Marvel and DC jobs? I think Dave Sim had the formula down. Dave Sim said, write your book, get a 5-issue thing written, and then do one page a week. It's a little extra work. Find the 8 hours a week to do one page a week, and this is for artists. This is for writers who could draw their own stuff. I guess for writers, you'd have to find somebody to draw it for you. But the point being is if you do a page a day, you do 4 pages a month, within a year, you've got 2 issues done. Check my math on that. But the basic idea being that you slowly do it over a build, and then you put out your creator-owned book. There are ways to do both. Are you going to go off and become a super millionaire? Chances are you're not. But that's not really why you should be doing it in the first place, The difficulty comes in doing something that's pure, that's how you want to do it. Like Strange Girl, I knew, look, I'm trying to mix Tank Girl and Preacher and Road Warrior in tone. I know that that is a limited audience, and I'm doing something that's theological in tone. And no matter what sort of a centrist position I try and take on this, where I'm just examining, some theological issues through the course of an action-adventure book, that's going to be a difficult sell to a lot of places. Yeah. But you do it because you want to do it. You do it because you like the idea. You do it because this gets you excited to write about it. And you don't do it because, if you start pandering, if you start thinking solely in terms of what's going to sell, which I'm not going to lie, I've done, if you think solely in those terms, you're not going to be doing anything different than if you were just working on, a corporate-owned character. And so ultimately the middle ground is the best, you do both. And I couldn't be happier. I couldn't be having more fun doing this. If my career continues on the path it's on right now for the rest of my life, I'd be set.
Yeah, well, I mean, because there's the argument between and putting, Kirkman and anything else that aside, looking purely at it, where, Marvel and DC aren't going anywhere. That's a steady job. It's a steady paycheck. But the potential for, if Fear Agent or the End League gets, picked up for a movie or for anything like that, that's good for you, right? And as opposed to writing a scene that makes it into the fourth Punisher movie that you never see a dime from.
Of course. Yeah, of course. But you also have to consider how many creator-owned books actually generate that revenue.
Right.
The idea here is that you do both. You put your heart and soul into both. You don't hack out your Marvel or DC work because it's a paycheck. Because all you do is you piss off the people who bought the book, and you shit on the editor who hired you, and you shit on the company who's putting money in your pocket. Mm. You go through and you kill yourself on your creator-owned. You kill yourself. And when I say kill yourself, I mean when you're done with it, it's the best you could do with the time you're allotted. If you had a week to do it, it's the absolute best you can do. If you had to find an extra, pull an all-nighter to tweak, burp, my wife handed me a beer and now I'm burping at you. if you have to tweak the dialogue till 5 in the morning to get it to where you want it and recover the next day, you do it. You make sure that both jobs, you never hack. You give it your all. And you do both. Unfortunately, the situation comes down to most creator-owned books in this market don't do so well.
Mm. Well, and then how much? I mean, and it's absolutely agreed. And I was talking to Jay Ferber a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about he's saying how you do the books for the love of it, and you don't do a book with the hopes to turn it into a movie. But that's got to be on your mind at some point, right? I mean, it's a revenue stream.
It's not on my mind.
Wow.
At all.
Interesting.
What it is nice if it happens, but the only book, and I'll be frank, when Tony and Kieran and I were kicking around XXX Zombies, that did start off as how do we make some money, which there's going to be news coming up where that's going to be turned into a film and we're writing a screenplay. The concept is a laugh. you know, is a goof. You're like, it's porn in 1976 during a zombie apocalypse.
It's so exploitative. It's right in your face, though.
Yeah, and I mean, it's punching you in the face with it. It's like, look, I mean, we have zombies tearing off girls' clothes, and, you know, I mean, it's fucking ridiculous fun. It's fun. Yeah. But that was clearly, I mean, that was a contrivance. I'm not gonna mince words on that one. With the intention of, hey, you know what, this would be a fun movie. This is actually a pretty fun idea. And we gave it everything we had and went as crazy with it as we could. I mean, I don't think you've seen a nun force a kid, you know, let her suck his dick at gunpoint anywhere else.
I just finally purged that from my mind, Rick. I just finally got it out last week.
Let nuns suck.
No, well, I mean, it's never going to leave your mind.
There should be an Eisner for that word balloon.
That
specific.
Let none suck.
Indeed.
I actually wrote that as a temporary piece of dialogue. Let none suck. And then when I went back, I was like, no, that's correct. Correct.
So,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. I was gonna say. So it's not on your mind. But if it happens, then great. So be it, and you'll reap the benefits from it. I mean, is
the End League has interest, and that was a comic book. The End League that was inspired by my desire to take and tell the last story, to tell the story that Marvel and DC couldn't, with amalgams of characters from both universes. The last story, the last adventure. And it is, you know, like that's what this is going to be. And it's not all, you know, it's not all bad. What's coming up in the story for these guys? But I didn't think that would have film potential at all.
And it has.
Oh yeah, wow. A lot. I mean, like what we have going on. Like right now, I'm writing the film treatment, and wow. You know, we'll see where it goes from there. But I didn't think anything. XXX Zombies, we thought it would sell as a comic book. And it was a contrivance that we then went through and had and worked really hard to make a good comic out of. The End League was just a comic book. It was absolutely the furthest from my mind as anything that would ever have film interest. But I think because of that, because of the purity of intention on it, it does work. And people respond. Burp. People respond to it.
It's a good beer, huh?
What is she doing to me here?
I don't know.
Loaded. I'm gonna start telling you dirty comic book secrets.
Oh.
we arranged to have her ply you with liquors.
Yeah. That's what we do, Rick. We just follow you around and then supply you with drinks.
So speaking of, let's wrap this up with the story. I'm gonna give you a scenario. We're eating dinner in Seattle, and we look over and we see Rick Remender sitting at a table with Dan DiDio. And we say to the waiter, can you give us the fruitiest, most ridiculous-looking drink possible and deliver it to that man over there? Now, granted, we wanted blue with lots of flowers and stuff, but what you got was pretty silly.
I think it was the fruitiest drink you get for Seattle, I think. That was pretty much what they could do.
Yeah, that was really horrible. You know, I was talking to them, and I was, you know, talking story stuff about this new project that I'm going to be writing for them based on a Grant Morrison Bible. And we're in the middle of this talk, and I'm, you know, I don't even remember what it was about, but I remember I was sitting there, and I was drinking a Jameson and a Guinness, and I was like getting all salty, and I was like, yeah, and this with writing, you got to get to the core of that and find this, and then this giant cock of a goblet covered in flowers and parasols and fruit and jism, it just was slid in front of me, and I was like, I thought for a second, like, well, who ordered, which one of these guys possibly ordered this ridiculous thing? And he's like, this is for you, sir. And I was like, what? And I look over, from those gentlemen. Oh, good. Well, that's fine, you know. I'd fuck you guys. It's cool.
That was the intention.
And that's how I fucked the guys that I fanboy.
So, you didn't lose the job because of that, because that's really what's been bugging us.
That was the worry about an hour afterwards.
I lost the job. Yeah, Dan DiDio said, no way. And he threw the table over, and he threw the drink in my face, and he goes, you are a foof. And he stormed out. Now, everybody got a good laugh. It was very funny. Ian and Dan both enjoyed your monkey shines.
You know, we were really like literally like an hour later, we're laughing about it, and then someone was just like, gee, I hope we didn't fuck up his pitch.
Yeah, it cuts to you guys somewhere laughing and having a beer, and I'm up in my hotel room in a bathtub cutting my penis with a razor blade, crying baby tears for the job I lost.
You had an opportunity to write. I could have written off a Grant Morrison Bible. Damn those guys.
And I'm drinking your fancy little foofy drink. Sip, 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 cut, 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 cry for my mom, cry for my mom, sip, 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 masturbate, cry, cut, drink.
Oh, well, on that note. So is there anything we didn't get? Anything else you want to plug? Anything else you want to tell people about? Or
let me check. Let's go to the plug list. Okay, so we got IDW's Blackheart Billy Color Edition trade paperback coming out in October, not to be missed. We got Booster Gold also launching in October, a two-issue arc written by Rick Remender, drawn by Pat Olson, and by Jerry Ordway. I don't know. We got Fear Agent with Tony Moore. I wish I could tell you who's drawn my first arc of Punisher War Journal. You're going to love it when you find out. But I'm going to save. When I was inking the Avengers, I didn't remember. I had been out of comics for about a year, and this is back in 2000, 2001. I didn't remember what a big deal the Avengers were, so I sent out an email. Like, it was my Blackheart Billy mailing list. I'm like, "Dear Blackheart Billy fans, Blackheart Billy has a new story in the Fat Records thing, co-written by Fat Mike from NoFX. And also, I'm inking the Avengers. Kieran Dreyer's drawn it. Suck the dick. See ya." And it turns out that announcing the new art team on the Avengers, kind of a big deal. Yes? Yes? Kind of a big deal.
Kind of.
Not something you want to haphazardly do, say, like, I don't know, a month before the new artist has drawn anything. And the last thing he did was LCD, lowest comic denominator. So Kieran got an earful, and then it came down to, yeah, they weren't. So what I do now is keep my mouth the fuck shut. But anyway, so yeah, Punisher War Journal, I'm going to be doing that. Fraction and I still have a couple 3-4 issues coming out with Chaykin. Got Gigantic at Dark Horse. We got the End League. We got the Fear Agent. We got some other secret, top secret stuff at DC. We got the Court that we'll do.
So when do you sleep?
I don't. It's been horrible. I got out today and I went and bought one of these new. I got a new Posturepedic Herman Miller Aeron chair.
Nice.
Oh God, it's so wonderful. I could make fuck to this chair right now.
No, but seriously, you're writing. You're doing stuff for Marvel, for DC, for Image, for Dark Horse, for IDW, for Devil's Due. Is there a publisher you're not working with?
Yes.
Yes.
Screw those guys at Boom.
Yeah, Boom and Dynamite can suck it. No, I'm kidding. They're very nice people.
Uh-oh. Ding dong. That was not recommended speaking.
Back to the bathtub with Razor again.
No, but seriously, I mean, that's a lot of projects, man. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really gratifying that people want to do my silly comic books. It's nice.
Oh, well, that's a good note. I think we end it there.
Thanks once again to Rick Remender for sitting and talking to us for such a long time. If you want more from Rick, you can go to rickremender.com. And if you want more of anything else and you want to go and comment on this show or all the other stuff we have at ifanboy.com, please get over there. And thanks very much.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert-extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.